It's Tuesday, May 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Syrian forces target Islamic State fighters in Palmyra.
Basically kidnapping people and holding them for ransom back in these poor villages where they've come from. It's really quite almost bizarre, this sort of behavior.
Malaysian authorities say they have discovered dozens of suspected graves. The ruling party in Turkey is seeking to extend its rule. Some computer users may be having their data held hostage for ransom. A Grammy Award-winning band has new music out. We'll sample it. It's all coming up today on VOA's International Edition. Turkey's foreign minister says his government has agreed in principle with the United States to provide air protection to Syrian rebels being trained to fight Islamic State militants in Syria. Also Monday, a U.S. defense official told VOA that Washington was in ongoing discussions with Ankara, but that no decisions have been made. Ankara has been reluctant to dispatch any military power across its borders in the conflict. Meanwhile, activists said Syrian government forces carried out at least 15 airstrikes Monday, targeting Islamic State fighters in the central city of Palmyra. VOA's Jeffrey Young spoke with Colin Clark, associate political scientist at the RAND Corporation Pittsburgh, about the difficulties in cutting revenue streams funding Islamic State and the financial importance of holding Palmyra.
It's clearly a very strategic move on the part of ISIS. This is a group that's continued to diversify its funding portfolio and develop a fairly robust resource base. It smuggles and traffics oil and looted antiquities, which is what Palmyra will be used for, as well as the continued extortion and protection payments that ISIS extracts from the population in the areas under its control, kidnapping for ransom, looting of state-owned banks. So clearly, this is a group that is prepared to adapt.
The global financial system has been largely locked down to them, or has it? How are they able to pay their salaries, pay for things?
Yeah, great question. As far as we know, the money is largely stayed out of the international financial market. Certainly banks, correspondent banks, and even larger banks are on the lookout for that. But what we know about ISIS that differentiates it from previous terrorist groups is that the bulk of its funding is raised and spent locally. And so cash does change hands, but it doesn't necessarily have to cross international borders, although it does on a more regional basis with money flowing back and forth between Syria and Iraq and up into Turkey as well.
The airstrikes that have been conducted against the Islamic State, some of them have been focused specifically on refineries and pipelines that try to cut that revenue stream. Has the United States and its coalition partners been successful in disrupting their financial inflows?
Yeah, I think that the airstrikes actually have been effective in curtailing some of ISIS's revenue that the group has gained through the smuggling and trafficking of oil. But like I just mentioned, the group has a diverse funding portfolio, so when the oil revenues run low, the group simply switches to more reliance on looting state-owned banks in Iraq and extortion and taxation in the areas under its control. And so what I'd like to just point out here is the critical importance of the control of territory, because with control of the territory, ISIS can then tax the people who live under its control. And furthermore, these people are a bit more willing to part with their money because ISIS is providing all the trappings of governance.
Is there any straightforward solution for chopping off their revenue?
It's a combination of kinetic and non-kinetic activities. It's continued targeting of the mobile oil refineries, but it's also continuing to beef up border security. I think right now we're somewhat confounded because we haven't seen a group with so many different ways to make money. And the fact that the money is locally raised and locally spent means that we're more reliant than ever on local security forces, which, as we've seen, haven't really been up to snuff.
Colin Clark is associate political scientist at the RAND Corporation in Pittsburgh. I'm Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
On our website at voanews.com, our audience is commenting on these developments. And after several days of finger-pointing by U.S. and Iraqi officials seeking to blame each other for Islamic State advances, U.S. Vice President Joe Biden reaffirmed Washington's support for the Iraqi government on Monday. Senior U.S. officials Sunday had questioned the will of Iraqi forces in the ongoing battle against Islamic State militants, drawing a sharp response from Baghdad. Theodore Frimmet wrote to us. He said Iraq's prime minister is correct in his assessment of winning a war against ISIS. His borders are secure and need only the advice of his armed forces. You can write to us at voanews.com. Leave your comments there. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Malaysian authorities say they have discovered dozens of suspected graves in nearly 30 abandoned camps along its border with Thailand, believed to be used by human traffickers of Rohingya Muslims fleeing Myanmar. A similar discovery was made by Thai police earlier this month. More than 3,600 people, about half from Myanmar, also known as Burma, and the rest from Bangladesh, have landed on the shores of Malaysia, Thailand, and Indonesia. Thousands more are believed to be adrift in the Bay of Bengal and the Andaman Sea. Meanwhile, Indonesia has started a search and rescue operation for those aboard such migrant boats, reversing a policy of pushing the boat people back out to sea. Kevin Evans, an Australian native who operates a website in Jakarta, told VOA's Victor Beattie he suspects the Rohingyas and Bangladeshis will be treated differently.
I suspect the future for the Bangladeshis is much less clear in terms of any hope for moving to a third country. I suspect they'll eventually be repatriated back to Bangladesh where there's less problems. With regards to the ones from Myanmar, they've agreed to this sort of one-year temporary accommodation process, but I suspect nobody's going in there with closed eyes, that's not going to necessarily be all concluded in 1 year. And since then, more recently, the government of Indonesia, from the Vice President's office, has instructed the National Disaster Management Agency to begin providing support to these people in the camps where they've been located along the coast of northern Sumatra.
Kevin, where are they putting them? Are they building refugee camps?
That will be the next thing, as to where they're actually being housed. And that's, I think, the start of the process launched by the National Disaster Management Agency. I think they'll be co-located somewhere close to the coastlines where they arrived and placed in temporary housing facilities. And I'm not expecting them to be building great big jails for housing these people like is done in other places. But they'll be located fairly close to communities and so forth, so that there's some degree of access and it's easy to get supplies to them.
How many people are we talking about?
Look, I'm guessing there's maybe a couple of thousand right now, but there's a lot of others who are still floating on the ocean somewhere out of Myanmar, Bangladesh area, down to the south end of the Andaman Sea. So still a few thousand more to go, but I don't know what impact this might have in terms of encouraging a lot of others to take flight. That may depend a little bit on the discussions that are taking place quietly with Myanmar's authorities on dealing with some of the substantive issues which are actually leading to this exodus.
There's a very disturbing report out of Malaysia today that authorities there said they discovered a series of graves on the border with Thailand where Rohingya Muslims fleeing Myanmar had been held. Obviously a very disturbing development.
Yes, quite horrific. And I think that adds to another element of this whole sordid tale has been the treatment of these people. It's really quite disgraceful behavior, basically kidnapping people and holding them for ransom back in these poor villages where they've come from. It's really quite almost bizarre, this sort of behavior. But to find this, particularly on Malaysian soil, I think would be quite shocking to Malaysian authorities. And I think that will be another element of the combined efforts in the region will actually be going after those people who are engaging in this disgraceful behavior.
Pope Francis on Sunday at his Pentecost message in St. Peter's Square brought this whole issue to the attention of those who were gathered there. Obviously, this has drawn quite a bit of international attention.
And so it should. And in some respects, it was perhaps a helpful message to remind the wider international community on the plight of these people. And it's probably also a helpful message for particularly for Indonesia, where they're willing to take in these people on a short-term basis, that it might help some of those countries that are final settlement recipient type countries, that to give some attention to this area and hopefully pick up a few of these people as and bring them in as refugees.
On Saturday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called for the finding and saving of the lives of the migrants at sea to be made a top priority. Malaysia and Thailand last week said they would provide temporary shelter for up to 1 year for the migrants recently found or still stranded at sea. It's now 16 minutes past the hour, and we'll be right back after a brief look at the day's news.
Here are the headlines from VOA. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden telephoned Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi Monday to thank Iraqi forces for what he called their enormous sacrifice and bravery against Islamic State militants. The call was apparently aimed at soothing Iraqi anger after U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter said Sunday that Iraqi forces retreated from Ramadi last week because they have no will to fight. Turkey's foreign minister says his government has agreed in principle with the United States to provide air protection to Syrian rebels being trained to fight Islamic State militants in Syria. A U.S. defense official told VOA there were ongoing discussions with Turkish officials, but that no decisions have been made. Malaysia's police chief says 139 graves believed to contain the remains of migrants have been found near the country's border with Thailand. I'm Dave DeForest, VOA News.
This is VOA's International Edition. Turkey's ruling AK Party is seeking a fourth successive general election victory with the goal of securing the two-thirds of parliamentary seats it would need in order to rewrite the constitution. To achieve that, the party, which has Islamist roots, will need to take seats from secular opposition strongholds like the western city of Izmir. That's where Dorian Jones brings us this report.
AK Party Member of Parliament Nesrin Ulama is rallying the party faithful. The party needs to score heavily in opposition strongholds like Izmir if it's to achieve its goal of securing enough seats to rewrite the constitution. Ulama is confident they have a broad appealing message.
Ülkemiz açısından dünya ile yarışır birçok dev projeyi de.
We are initiating a period with giant projects aimed at our people, but at the same time will keep us in the competition with the world. She said for this new period, we've taken the steps for two nuclear power stations, also for one of the biggest airports in the world. A decade of economic prosperity has been key to AK Party's success and broad appeal, even in opposition strongholds. But the economy is now slowing. In areas which traditionally offer strong AK support, there are grumbles about business. The AK party is also running its first election without its charismatic leader, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is now president. Ahmet Davutoğlu is the leader facing the challenge, says Betül Durmaz, a teacher of sociology at Izmir's Gediz University.
Recep Tayyip Erdogan was very strong leader, and right now, we saw that Davutoğlu is still doing lots of mistakes. For that reason, voters still confused about who is the leader of the AKP.
But in Izmir, the AK party, like in the rest of the country, has a formidable party machine that no other party can rival. That advantage has been key to its previous electoral success and could yet prove decisive in next month's elections, says AK Member of Parliament Ulama.
Gerçekleştirmiş olduğu bu sağlam yapı doğrultusunda da bugün
this is our biggest secret behind AK Party, which resulted in its 14 years in power and success in 9 consecutive elections. Our party has about 4 million female members, and behind all of our political success lies house visits of our women branches and women members. Ulema is using this advantage to the fullest. These visits are great. We can talk about our problems face to face, this woman says. Izmir is a staunchly secular city whose voters fear the growing conservatism of the current government. As a result, the ruling party is pressing hard to make inroads in this city, using its grassroots canvassing in the living rooms of the electorate. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Izmir, Western Turkey.
There's more International Edition on the way in just a moment. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
You sit down at your computer and go online, and then a message appears on your screen telling you that all of your files have been taken, but you may have them back if you pay a specified amount of money. It doesn't seem too widespread at the time, but the cyber threat of ransomware seems to be growing. My colleague Susan Yockey and cyber correspondent Doug Bernard discuss how hackers extort your personal information.
There's an old internet scam floating around that's getting some new attention lately. It's called ransomware. And if you're unlucky, it may have already infected your computer or mobile phone. Joining us now is VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's this all about anyway?
Well, Susan, recently the FBI issued a public warning for people in the United States, alerting them to a recent spread in ransomware. Now, ransomware is basically a bug, a bit of malware. These bugs have been around since at least the early 90s, so it's nothing new. But what we are seeing is a recent renewal in Japan, in Australia, in Western Europe. They really tend to be spreading very fast. So here's how it works. Basically, your computer is infected. Perhaps you click on a link that you shouldn't, or maybe you're not using antivirus or something like that. So a bug, a bit of malware, lands on your computer, and quietly it encrypts certain kinds of files on your computer. And these types of files are things that are traditionally called user-generated, so Word documents, spreadsheets, pictures, videos, that kind of thing, things that you probably that mean a lot to you. So when you go and try and access one of these files, you get a little pop-up, and the pop-up basically says your files have been encrypted. We're holding them ransom, and until you pay us, say, maybe $300, you're not going to get them back.
Well, is this just a scam, or do you really get your files back?
Well, one analyst I spoke with says, you know, this is really a business of sorts. So in some ways, it's a scam. The bad guys are trying to extort money from you. But they want it also known that if indeed you pay them, say, $300 or something, that indeed they will give you that key and you will be able to unlock your files, because chances are you'll mention that to somebody else. The word gets around that for a fee that's sort of troublesome, but, you know, $300. Maybe for some people that's troublesome and irritating, but, you know, worth it to get their important trusted files back.
But you have to trust a crook.
You do have to trust a crook. But again, if you're thinking that the crooks make their money from this, if it becomes known that they're just scamming you out of $300, then nobody's going to send them money anymore. But if it gets out there that indeed, you know, if you pay up, you'll get the key and you'll get your documents back, that's actually to the benefit of the bad guys.
Well, how do you protect yourself from this?
Well, once you're infected, unfortunately, there's basically nothing that you can do. These ransomware bugs use very strong encryption, encryption levels essentially that the NSA couldn't even break. So the thing that you need to do is mitigate to protect yourself in case that you are infected. That means back up your computer. Back it up often, and back it up maybe to several different locations that aren't connected permanently to your computer, external drives. It's also just very important, again, to use a antivirus program. Symantec, Kaspersky, Norton, there's a bunch out there, and they are pretty good at sniffing out these bugs before they actually infect your computer.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Doug.
Hope you keep safe out there.
Thank you. That's VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard.
It's not a virus, but it's spreading pretty fast. New music by Grammy Award-winning Train, and they have a new album out. VOA Border Crossing host Larry London talks about it with Bob Doty.
When I think about my problems, and I truly understand, in a world like this, being a white man, I'm ashamed that I complain. I'm not sure that I know pain, but I know this.
Larry, we're talking about Train.
Yes,
we
are.
Who's on the track?
Who's on the track? Well, Train's on the track. Train have a new album out, which is called Bulletproof Picasso. It's their seventh album since they began in 1993 together. Their first album, 1998, which was called Train, went platinum and had a huge hit for them, a song that was called Meet Virginia. And then several years later, in 2001, they put out another album, which called Drops of Jupiter. The title track earned them two Grammy Awards that year.
Two Grammys. Wow.
And we were just listening to a song off the new album, Bulletproof Picasso. The song is called Give It All, which Pat Monahan, the lead singer of the band, says it kind of reminds him of the fact that May is Mental Health Awareness Month.
Oh, yeah.
And the song is very powerful. It has a message about loss and about healing and about letting go. So the band feel that this single is very timely for this particular month and what we're thinking about at this time.
So this is the latest current hit for them?
Yep, it's their new song, and it's, as I say, off the seventh album, Bulletproof Picasso, which for the band Train is kind of a little departure over the last couple of albums, because recently in the last few years they've released albums about their home San Francisco, California.
Right.
And so, like, the last album they had out was called California 37, which is the name of a highway in San Francisco that runs through San Francisco. So it's very interesting. They love San Francisco. They've just started a wine company. How many bands have their own wine?
I can't think of one of them.
You can't think of, well, now there's Train. So you can add that to your list.
But they
list.
Can load up all their wines on the train.
That's it.
Oh, no, I didn't say that.
But, you know, some of their wines include the Save Me San Francisco Wine Company. They've released Drops of Jupiter.
And there's much more on our website at voanews.com. You've been listening to International Edition. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Like many nations, the United States pauses each year to honor those who died in its defense through military service. The custom is an ancient one, recalling a speech by the Athenian statesman Pericles that the casualties of war are worthy men, and the living need not have a more heroic spirit. On Monday, May 25th, Memorial Day, in communities across America, there will be speeches striking similar themes, and a moment of silence will be observed. Like the poppies in Flanders Fields, small flags will be seen among the graves in the nation's many military cemeteries, and the families of the fallen will stop to remember. Beyond mere ceremony, the day represents a debt paid by the living to those Americans who made the ultimate sacrifice to ensure their country's freedom. Some died in battle, some of disease. Others were lost in foreign prisons and never returned. Most died very young, defending their nation's ideals and liberties, perhaps even before they had much of a chance to fully appreciate them. Hundreds of thousands died fighting to make others free too, in North Africa, Europe, the Pacific, Asia, and the Middle East. Memorial Day honors no single battle or war. Its meaning transcends heroic monuments. Rather, it is the recognition by a grateful nation that lives and blood lost in defense of its freedoms are never given in vain.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.